Greetings and felicitations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this July 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of purely wondrous adulteration and exhortatious hedonism, Jim Campanella. To mix a metaphor immediately, let's get this puppy rolling. My allusion a second ago to adulteration was more than just a bit of me being silly. The first three stories of the night are all related to each other, because they involve cheating, lying, and yes, even being adulterous. Apparently in the last month there has been a perfect storm of research looking at infidelity and honesty. Or dishonesty, as the case may be. Have you ever met a guy and immediately distrusted him because of his looks? I'm not talking about race here, or a lack of sartorial resources, so to speak, or even the fact that he may be, well, less than scrupulous with his hygiene. I'm talking just looking at a man's face and feeling more than a bit uneasy about trusting him. Well, according to Dr. Michael Hasselhoon at the University of Wisconsin, some men simply have untrustworthy faces. He published this result in this month's issue of the Proceedings of the Royal Society. According to his statistical analysis, men with wide faces more often deceived partners in negotiations, lacked marital fidelity, and cheated in money-making games more than thin-faced men did. Men with wide faces had a heightened feeling of personal power, and this feeling apparently encouraged their unethical deeds. The authors propose that certain physical traits have evolved as signals of male dominance and aggression, including wide faces. So it kind of makes sense that certain physical features can predict things like unprincipled behavior. The authors add that broad-faced women show no penchant for lying and cheating, just men. And I kind of go along with this result. I mean, for a long time I've had a theory which I call the somatophysiognomy theory of behavior, which, by the way, has absolutely no support whatsoever, except for my own kind of demented observations. In my personal experience, I found that people with similar physical and facial features often seem to have similar personalities. In short, people who look alike will often act alike, even if genetically unrelated. I know from a scientific standpoint that makes no sense whatsoever, without any evidence to back it up, but I've seen it again and again. I'm just curious whether listeners think that is completely off the wall, or whether they've experienced anything similar in their lives. Anyway, the second cheating story of the night is not about humans, but about birds. Dr. Wolfgang Forstmeier of the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology has been studying captive zebra finches and their behavior for years, and he just published some of his results in the Proceedings of the National Academy on female infidelity among the supposedly monogamous finches. Apparently for years it's bothered scientists that you often see female infidelity in species that supposedly mate for life. Males cheat because it's to their advantage to spread their genes around as much as possible in a population. That means that male philandering leads to more offspring the following spring. But females have no reason to cheat. No matter how many males they dally with, they'll have the same number of offspring. In fact, it may be a bad thing for females to cheat because it can lead to such things as extra childcare duties because the ill-treated, cuckolded male bird is slacking off on his parenting. One theory has suggested that females cheat not because they have any advantage in cheating, but because, just like males, they inherit the same cheating genes. So female cheating may just be a side effect of the enormous benefit males derive from spreading their seed as widely as possible. And this theory goes back about 24 years, and it's been tested very little since it was proposed that long ago. Because Forstmeier has a huge number of animals to examine in close detail in a controlled space, he was finally able to examine the hypothesis that has been floating around for a couple of decades. Forstmeier and his colleagues filmed and monitored paternity for five generations of birds, a total of 800 males and 754 females. The researchers switched many of the chicks from their original nests and determined that nature, not nurture, was influencing at least the finch sexual behavior. And the scientists painstakingly documented who mated with or rebuffed whom. It's reported that Forstmeier himself watched about 1,000 finch courtships on video. About this, he said, quote, "It never really got boring." His co-author, Catherine Martin, watched about 3,000 to 4,000 courtships and had a similar response. I'm just curious if these are available on YouTube. At any rate, the conclusion is strong support for genetics having control of female infidelity, again, at least in finches. It's still possible that there are other explanations. For example, it may be that female cheating is beneficial to both sexes. I mean, think about it for a second. If there is a cheating gene, then why not a fidelity gene? If females have a fidelity gene, then it could be selected in males. And if it was selected in males, it would actually hurt the species if males stopped their extracurricular activities by reining in their philandering. Having the infidelity be on both sides, male and female, and the fidelity as well, balances out the genetic outcomes. Our third cheating story answers the following question. Okay, fine, so finches cheat on each other, and that's genetic. Is it genetic in humans as well? And what advantage would the human female get from cheating on her husband? Behavioral scientist Dr. Brooke Skelza of UCLA tried to answer this question in this month's issue of the Journal of Biology Letters. And the paper is entitled, Female Choice and Extra Pair Paternity in a Traditional Human Population. Basically, the paper asked the question, what advantage does a woman have to cheat on her husband? Certainly as in the finches, it does not increase the number of children. Skelza found that among African herders known as the Himba, adulterous encounters reported by married women account for 17% of the women's offspring. Now, the one advantage appears to be that the Himba women who stray have more children who survive into adulthood than those who stay faithful. Now, what is even more interesting is that almost all these women are in arranged marriages. Women in these arranged loveless marriages sought affairs to escape parental authority and control reproductive decisions, Skelza suggests. Apparently also, Himba men leave home for long periods. They know about this unfaithfulness, and they tolerate their adulterous wives because additional children provide valuable labor to the tribe. This is Skelza's view, at least. The paper also notes that there are no cases of children being produced through extramarital affairs in what Skelza calls, quote, love match marriages, unquote. That is, pairs of people who were not in arranged marriages but actually loved each other to start with. The rate of so-called extra pair paternity is higher in the Himba than has been recorded in any small-scale society on the face of the earth at the moment. Okay, this entire line of stories is getting depressing. Let's look at something completely different. For the last 40 years or so, geneticists have thought that they had it pretty much figured out how genes work, and proteins are coded from those genes. I mean, there have been some minor bumps along the way. For example, we no longer say that the one gene produces one enzyme hypothesis works. Dr. George Beadle actually got a Nobel Prize for that, and we no longer say that that's true anymore. By the way, I'm always amused at the number of Nobel Prize winners over the years whose contributions have been shown to be just part of the story or just plain wrong-headed. At any rate, we believed Beadle's hypothesis for several decades and then found out differently when it turned out that the messenger RNA that got coded from a gene could be chopped up in a variety of ways to give you different proteins. So that meant one gene could produce several different enzymes. That was a bit of a monkey wrench, but it was completely understandable and reproducible. In fact, it's been an important discovery because it explains how the genome of about 25,000 human genes can produce so many more proteins. Now we have a whole new monkey wrench being thrown at us, and this is a serious one because scientists are terrified of all the potential complications. In short, what we thought we understood, we may not understand at all, and the process of protein translation may be a bigger black box than we ever suspected. So what am I referring to? University of Rochester scientists Drs. Yi-Tao Yu and John Karajolich have published a paper in the prestigious journal Nature this month, explaining why what we think we know about genetics may be wrong. The paper is entitled Converting Nonsense Codons into Sense Codons by Targeted Pseudouridylation. For those of you who do not remember, the central dogma of genetics goes something like this. DNA stores all the information of the cell. Messenger RNA is transcribed and coded from the genes in the DNA. That messenger RNA is then translated at a structure called a ribosome into protein sequences. And finally, it's the protein in many forms that actually controls and regulates what goes on in the cell. That's the pathway of the information, from the DNA to the RNA to the protein. When proteins are being translated from messenger RNA, that process of translation is stopped by one of three triplet codes that have the base uridine in them. These are called stop codons. What you and Kara Jolich found is that if you replace the uridine in the stop codon with a rare RNA base called pseudouridine, then you do not get a stop. In other words, the protein making machinery runs right through the stop sign and into the sequence territory, which it's not supposed to use to make further protein. You might just think of this as kind of silly and not very important, but it's not just a kind of run-of-the-mill molecular traffic violation, if you want to call it that. It results in an entirely different protein than the one encoded by DNA. And this is a clear violation of the central dogma that I just described. The enzymes that copy DNA to RNA and vice versa can't tell the difference between the uridine and the pseudouridine, but that subtle chemical tweak, as one author suggests, is akin to writing a letter in a hard-to-read font, like a Byzantine font, and it gives an entirely different meaning for the ribosome as it translates. There are two reasons that this traffic snafu might lead to a major finding. First, there are 61 codon triplets that we know of that code regularly in all DNA on the face of the earth, whether you're an E. coli or a palm tree or a Peruvian anteater. 61 codons, that's it. As far as we know, it doesn't change in any organism anywhere. This is how we're all related. It is a universal code. Now, when pseudouridine is added into the mix instead of uridine, and by the way, it is a naturally occurring base in mRNA. This is not something that you don't see. You actually create new codon triplets. This is something that has never been anticipated and never predicted. Remarkably, pseudouridylated nonsense codons code for specific amino acids and not the ones that scientists would have predicted. Specifically, pseudo-AA and pseudo-AG code for serine and threonine, whereas the triplet pseudo-GA codes for tyrosine and phenylalanine. Those are four major amino acids. Now, if this is a natural process seen in nature, it suggests a whole new mode of decoding triplets. That is, new codons that we did not know even existed. Of course, the real question is whether pseudouridine plays a part in changing the genetic code in nature, and that really remains to be seen. If it turns out that this is a natural phenomenon and not just a weird lab thing, it may mean that we do not understand ribosomes or the process of translation as well as we did. The other reason that this is so important is that it provides potential treatment for genetic diseases that are presently untreatable, which have mutant stop codons in the middle of genes. You and Kara Jolich's technique might be used to fix genetic errors. Introducing stop sign busting pseudouridine into an RNA may one day help people with rare genetic diseases in which one of their genes contains an early stop codon. This may all sound a bit abstruse to the layman, but in terms of molecular biology and genetics, it may represent a real step forward, a quantum leap. Okay, let's go on to something entirely different. I'm sure you've all read speculative fiction or seen bad SF movies where an alien has an amazing ability to interfere with some sort of detection device and somehow throw off its searchers from the scent of it. Well, that is in some part the realm of fiction, but there's at least one animal on the face of the earth which has the ability to block sonar. No, not sonar from ships or submarines, but sonar from bats of all things. The tiger moth is the only animal in nature known to defend itself by jamming the sonar of its predators, that is, bats. Dr. Alan Corcoran and his colleagues from Wake Forest University studied the abilities of these moths in this month's Journal of Experimental Biology. Corcoran analyzed the three-dimensional flight paths and echolocation behavior of big brown bats attacking tiger moths in a flight room over seven consecutive nights to determine the acoustic mechanism of the sonar jamming defense. In the past, the literature has proposed three different mechanisms for how this jamming might work. First, something they call the phantom echo hypothesis. And this states that bats misinterpret moth clicks as echoes. Second, the ranging interference hypothesis, which states that moth clicks degrade the bat's precision in determining target distance. And three, the masking hypothesis, which states that moth clicks actually mask the moth echoes entirely and make them temporarily invisible, a little like a stealth airplane. The authors took bats and moths and examined them again over a series of nights to determine which theory may be the correct one. On nights 1 and 2 of the experiment, the bats appeared startled by the clicks. However, on nights 3 through 7, the bats frequently missed their prey by a distance of 15 to 20 centimeters. This supports the ranging interference hypothesis. Three-dimensional simulations show that the bats did not avoid phantom targets, and the bats' ability to track clicking prey contradicted the predictions of the masking hypothesis. So the moths were not just invisible to the bats. They could be detected. The scientists observed also that the moth clicks forced the bats to reverse their typical pattern of echolocation emissions during attack, even while bats continued the pursuit of the moths. That change in their response further hindered the bats' ability to track their prey. So it appears that the ranging interference hypothesis is the correct one, and that the moths are simply throwing off the senses of the bats so that they're no longer accurate. This may have Department of Defense uses in the future to protect ships and airplanes. Okay, onward and upward. With the ending of Harry Potter this month and the finale movie, I feel like I should make some passing reference to the boy wizard. The next story is only vaguely related to Harry, but I can stretch things for once. I'm sure that you remember that through much of the series, Harry used the Cloak of Invisibility, one of those Deathly Hallows, to good effect to help hide himself and his friends and protect themselves. Well, imagine that Harry had a cloak that didn't just hide him in space, as the Invisibility Cloak did, but in time. Voldemort would have been even more scared of Harry than he was. Imagine being able to temporarily hide an event in time. Dr. Mati Fridman and his co-authors at Cornell University report at the Cornell Online Science Archive the first experimental demonstration of what you might call temporal cloaking. The team was able to temporarily tear a hole in a beam of light, and events that occurred during that brief period of time remained unseen, as did the hole itself. In the past, invisibility cloaks hid objects from view by bending light around them. Just like water flows around a rock in a river, light curves around a cloak and then rejoins perfectly on the other side, and it leaves no trace of that detour. A time cloak conceals an event by changing light's speed, not its direction. With the speed of light being a maximum of about 300 million meters per second, this trick works only when light travels slower than it would travel through a vacuum. For example, when it moves through a fiber optic cable. The Cornell team, by the way, has not actually published their results yet. They've only reported them at Cornell's online depot of information for its faculty, which has a minimum of information. However, there is enough info there to know that they manipulated light in a fiber optic cable using something called a time lens. A time lens is a silicon device originally developed to speed up data transfer. Some of the light passing through this lens speeds up and some of it slows down. The waves divide like the Red Sea being parted, creating a gap of darkness. And a second lens farther along the cable then stitches the light back together so that it arrives at its destination intact, with no record of the hole or anything that happened during this brief window of opportunity. Mind you that no one is going to be using this very soon to cloak a tank or anything. The hole they created lasted for about 15 trillionths of a second, long enough to conceal pulses of light created inside the cloak. They suggested that the longer the optic cable used, the longer the time gap would become, in theory at least. They also stated that the longest gap they could theoretically manage was a bit more than a microsecond. longer than that, and imperfections in the technique would grow large enough to reveal the presence of the gap, and invisibility would become, well, pointless. Previously, scientists thought that you could only make a time cloak with exotic metamaterials and an invisibility cloak thrown into the mix. The imperfect Cornell cloak, which is not made of metamaterials, may be useful for signal processing. It could, in theory, interrupt one data stream and allow another to be processed, and then reconstitute the original stream for a detector that would be unaware of the interruption. Larger time gaps on everyday scales, though, are pretty unlikely. Even with a theoretically perfect metamaterial cloak, the authors estimate that a mere 8-minute time gap would require a device the size of the solar system. All right, let's finish out the night with two final stories that are updates on previous stories that we've discussed in the past. First, you may remember from at least a year ago, if not longer, we had a story discussing the viral plague that seems to be hitting Tasmanian devils down under. It causes a fatal infectious cancer and is making major inroads in wiping out the species. Doctors Stephen Schuster and Webb Miller of Penn State University have published in the latest issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy that they now have two new complete sets of Tasmanian devil genetic blueprints. These genomes hold some good news and some bad news for the devils. The bad news is that the marsupial's genetic diversity is among the lowest known for any species. You may remember that genetic diversity is the differences in the genome over an entire species. And low genetic diversity is a bad thing for beating a plague like the Tasmanian devils are facing. However, the good news is that the devil's low diversity has a long history and may not be a reason for as much concern as was once thought. Schuster says, quote, "This low genetic diversity does not mean the species is doomed. If you maintain the entire diversity, this can be a viable species," unquote. The two Tasmanian devils that were sequenced were named Cedric and Spirit. Cedric was one of the few devils whose immune system could fight off the infectious cancer, which started in a single long-dead devil and has since swept over more than half the island. As part of the efforts to study the disease, Cedric survived two attempts to infect him with the disease purposely, but he finally succumbed to the third strain. Spirit was already infected with 5 tumors and dying when she was captured. Researchers hoped that cataloging and comparing the two animals' genomes would show why Cedric was partially immune to the fatal cancer, while Spirit and so many others are not. The initial analysis of the two genomes has not yet provided a clear answer, but researchers believe that further work will reveal secrets to defeating the deadly disease that may be buried in the animals' blueprints. The authors suspect that most devils have variants in certain genes that make them more susceptible to the tumor disease. How bad is the genetic diversity of the devils? This new work shows that devil diversity is about 20% of that of humans. An analysis of DNA from museum specimens going back to 1874, at least 100 years before the infectious cancer first appeared, finds that Tasmanian devils have had that level of genetic diversity for a long time. The authors say that the devils have survived with low diversity for a long time and have done pretty well, but the entire point of the problems with low diversity, low genetic diversity, are this. Yes, you can do great for years and years at a time with low genetic diversity, and heck, you can even have an entire population of clones for centuries with no genetic diversity if you want to push the concept, but eventually, some environmental catastrophe is going to occur that will wipe out a population with little or no variation in it. This is exactly what's going on with the devils. They were doing great for centuries until a plague hit them, which few were immune to because their genetics are so homogeneous. Worse yet, it seems likely that because the devils are so genetically similar to one another, their immune systems may have trouble recognizing tumor cells passed on by another devil as not their own. There's a lesson to be learned here. The authors are hoping that human intervention and directed matings may help to increase genetic diversity and help the devils to survive in the long run. The final story of the night concerns, for the 4 millionth time, an update on bisphenol A, also known as BPA, and more of its horrific effects on humans. You may remember that BPA is a chemical toxin found in many clear plastics and store receipts, and it mimics human steroid hormones. Two new studies have just been published about two different species, which suggest further dire effects on males caused by BPA. The first study is by Dr. Cheryl Rosenfeld of the University of Missouri-Columbia and her colleagues, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy. It appears that early exposure of pregnant deer mice to BPA causes a rewiring of the brains of offspring, even if no further BPA is found in the blood of the offspring. Tests in offspring of the deer mice, of treated animals, evaluated spatial navigational abilities, something at which male deer mice normally excel at. Spatial learning abilities and exploratory behaviors were severely compromised in males that encountered early BPA doses relative to unexposed males. For example, a male released into a pen with many portals will seek the exit to its own cage. Unexposed males quickly learned how to find their exit and make a beeline to it. The BPA-exposed males, by contrast, tended to take random paths in trial after trial, or serially visit all the exits, and often didn't commit to any of them. In the study, BPA did not affect female behavior. However, all females found BPA-exposed males substantially less attractive. Rosenfeld is currently investigating what cues, such as scents or behaviors, the BPA-exposed males might be giving off. The second BPA story comes out of China from researchers at Zhejiang Normal University in Jinhua and was just published in the journal Neuropharmacology. These authors found pretty much the same results as the American team, except that they used standard lab mice. In their paper, they detail impaired spatial navigational abilities and exploratory behaviors in male lab mice that had been exposed to low levels of BPA beginning in adolescence, not given to their mothers in this case. These later exposures also affected females, the paper said. For example, boldened BPA-exposed females were willing to explore open areas as normal males typically would. I mean, I've been talking about BPA for a couple of years now, and with every new report I get more worried. These novel findings point to the fact that an early environmental exposure can manifest itself later in life, which is a very bad thing. I don't know why legislators in the U.S. do not simply put a ban on the substance as they have in Canada. I mean, we're really talking about the survival of our species here, as well as every other mammal on the face of the earth exposed to these toxins. It's a serious issue. That's enough ranting for the moment. I'll step down off my soapbox now. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. And need I say it, stay away from dishonest, broad-faced males affected by BPA. And I hope it inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.